Hello and welcome to another episode of PhD Pending, the podcast for early career humanities scholars. My name is Anna Mahler and I have a PhD in English literature. Together, we will deep dive into different aspects of PhD life and explore what it really means to do a PhD in the humanities. Over the last couple of seasons, it's become a bit of a tradition that the season finales are longer episodes, special episodes, we've reviewed Netflix shows, we've done big roundtable discussions, so I thought for this season finale, we need to come up with something special again. And this something special is super special because I got to sit down with my own PhD supervisor, Dr. Alan Gibbs, for a long, long interview about the entire PhD process from start to finish, from the view of a new PhD student and also a very experienced PhD supervisor. Now, we had so much fun recording that actually the episode was so long that we split it into two. So please enjoy the first part of our supervisor special and the first part of our season finale. So today's episode is a very special one to me because I get to sit down with my PhD supervisor, Dr. Alan Gibbs, for a big supervisor special. Alan, welcome to the show. Introduce yourself to our listeners, please.
Thank you, Anne. Good to be here. Yeah, okay. I'm Dr. Alan Gibbs. I work in the Department of English at UCC with a specialism in American literature, in particular contemporary American literature. And I suppose that branches into two particular kind of specialisms, which would be trauma theory and the representation of trauma, and more recently, an interest in naturalism, and especially contemporary neo-naturalism. And I'd say they're kind of broadly in American culture, because I've done quite a lot of work on kind of visual culture and TV series recently, I suppose, in publications.
I remember us chatting about you having to suffer through the later season of Dexter, I believe.
96 episodes. Yeah. That's the thing about the writing on the TV series. There's just so much of them. So I've done things like Dexter, The Shield, which is huge as well.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Oh, yes,
and
The Wire.
I'm just actually rewatching Breaking Bad and going to go through onto Better Call Saul in preparation for seeing the final series, which I haven't seen yet, so no spoilers, please. Which is kind of possibly semi-academic as well, because something might come of that. But
I still need to watch Better Call Saul, and my partner has a film degree. He's always on about that the last season is the best piece of television ever produced. So,
well, if he means the last season, which was kind of the penultimate one, I haven't seen the final season.
Yeah, the very final season. Well, I'm not going to spoil anything because I don't know anything, but apparently
this is currently airing.
Yeah, it is.
But so, yeah, I mean, the penultimate one was really good. So, I'm looking forward to getting to the
final one. Yeah, I did suffer through Breaking Bad a small bit, I have to say.
Mm.
But it was very well done.
Yeah, it's peculiar rewatching Breaking Bad. It's still really compelling, but there are things that are...
That you pick up on now.
Yeah, there are things I'm a little bit uneasy about.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the representation of race in it is iffy, I would say. And, it's still really compelling. But there are ways in, I think, to be quite critical about it as well.
Yeah. It's been a while since that ad for the first time, right? Was that
mid-2000s? The episodes I'm looking at the moment, which would be the fourth series, would be about 2011, I think.
Okay, yeah, so about a decade old.
It feels like another world already.
Well, if you're not suffering through Dexter or rewatching Breaking Bad, can you tell us what you did your PhD on?
Yeah, my PhD I did at the University of Nottingham. And it was on an American Jewish author called Henry Roth, who people always kind of confuse with Philip Roth, but he's much more obscure than that. He's a very interesting guy who was born in 1906, I think, in Eastern Europe, and his family emigrated when he was very young to New York City. In 1934, he published his first novel, which is this very kind of Joycean modernist novel called Call It Sleep, which was critically quite well received, but kind of died a death commercially. And he didn't write again for many, many years after that. Call It Sleep was rediscovered in the 1960s and published in a cheap kind of paperback edition, and then suddenly became a, you know, 30 years after its initial publication, became this New York Times bestseller. Everybody in New York was reading this book all of a sudden. And so he kind of made his way back into writing then. And then 60 years after publishing his first novel, he published his second, the first in the Mercy of a Rude Stream series. So my PhD was looking at this four-novel set that was published right at the end of his life. In fact, two novels before he died and two novels posthumously. So I looked at things like the editing history of this, because it was really interesting how it's written. I spent about 3 months in New York looking at his archive, looking at the manuscripts, because he'd worked over this stuff over about three or four decades. And interviewing people like his editor and his attorney and his publisher and his assistant. So, yeah, had a whale of a time in New York doing
that. That's so cool.
Yeah, yeah. He's a really interesting guy. Unfortunately, he remains rather obscure.
Yeah.
Undeservedly, I think. I think he's a very interesting writer. But,
yeah.
Yeah, so Henry Roth.
So you had a great PhD experience.
Yeah, yeah, no, I really did. I had a very good supervisory team as well, who, you know, I'm still in touch with. The kind of lead supervisor, she's now pretty much retired, and next year I'm actually going over to give a paper at an event that's kind of celebrating her retirement and all sorts of things. So that'd be lovely. Yeah,
that is so nice. It's almost like the circle.
Absolutely.
Closing.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah,
really
yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
And in terms of the track record of you supervising yourself, mm-hmm. right? So how many PhDs have you supervised? And
yeah.
Yeah.
I had to look this up, actually. I always forget how, you know, exactly how many. But yeah, nine. You were the eighth. And then Sarah, who's just successfully gone through her Viva, was my ninth. So.
Because
yeah.
I remember when I started, you had loads of PhDs,
yeah.
right? People were just finishing, and it was this kind of like overlapping period where a couple of new ones started, but a lot were just about to finish up.
Yeah.
So I think though you were like stockpiling the PhD students.
It's gone in huge waves. Like at one time I was supervising or co-supervising eight, which is way too many now I think about it, and I would never do that again. But it's really dropped down now, so that I only have one student who is actually part-time, who I'm co-supervising. I'm not really the lead supervisor there.
Mm.
But I do have a couple coming in probably this October who are kind of, again, co-supervised ones. So
not the recommendation to have eight at the time.
I would be reluctant to do more than four or the equivalent of four full-time ones now, I think, just because you're spreading yourself too thin. You can't give people the attention that they deserve.
Yeah.
You shouldn't do that many. So, yeah.
Because it is a lot of work, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think I was kind of overly keen as a newly appointed academic. Got to get the PhD students. And it just, yeah, it was too much.
Too much. You
yeah.
learned it the hard way.
Yeah, yeah.
And to get into our first question, just to set the scene a small bit. So in your opinion, or what have you experienced, what are some of the ways that you've been approached by students to become their supervisor? And is there kind of like a canonical best way to go about that?
Yeah, interesting question. I mean, most of the students initially came through the MA. Now, there used to be an MA in American Literature and Film, a separate MA. But going back a few years, after the Celtic Tiger collapsed and died, the local authority grant for MA students was withdrawn,
mm-hmm.
Which meant that our numbers plummeted, so we could no longer run that MA, and then it was kind of congealed into the Modernities MA.
Mm.
So I have fewer students coming through from that, but still reasonably steady flow. So, for example, Kieron came through the Modernities MA. I suppose it means that there are fewer students coming through with a specific interest in American literature. So there's a smaller pool there. But I still get students coming through from the MA. And then there would be students like yourself or Sarah who approached me presumably based on recommendations from MA supervisors or because you might have encountered my work outside, who approached me. which is a really interesting approach, and it demands a bit of a leap of faith on both my part and on the, you know, on your part as well. But in both cases, there that works out really successfully. I think the great thing there with a student approaching you from outside is that the likelihood is that they're really kind of enthusiastic about your research area, and so one of the really important things about PhD supervision is that there should be a pretty close match between the supervisor's research interests and the supervisee's. And if somebody is making that effort to approach you from outside the university, then there's probably more chance that that's going to be the case. And so the supervisory experience for me with both you and Sarah was very good, because we you know, there's a really good match between our research interests.
And it's quite interesting, because the difference, I think, in approaches between me and Sarah was that you two met at a conference in person, and you and I'm going to talk about this as well, because my way was a bit, how do I say it? Atypical, maybe?
Yeah.
Because we've never met before, and I came across your work during research for a potential PhD project, and I read it and I was like, this is the match in terms of theory. This is exactly what I'm looking for. And I spent a lot of time reading your work, getting really acquainted with it, and
stalking
you. No, just like really getting comfortable, because I wanted to make sure that if I send you an email, because again, what you were saying about the leap of faith, right? If I sent that email, it should be punchy enough and convincing enough to at least spark an interest, because obviously I know how busy people are, and I was assuming that you would get loads of those emails. So I just wanted to stand out, and I was like, okay, so I put a lot of pressure on that first email to make sure I weave in enough that I understand what you're talking about and that it matches with my ideas for the project, kind of. And it only occurred to me after a couple of years that we had been working together, and I talked to other PhDs, that you took quite a leap of faith, because we agreed to become supervisor and supervisee, and you agreed to take on my project. And we hadn't even met at that stage. So I think I didn't even realize at the time. I knew it was not typical, but I didn't realize how much of a leap of faith that actually was.
Well, you were very tenacious, and you convinced me with, you know, a series of very good, well-argued emails. Well, not argued, but you know... You explained your project really well. You seemed to know what you were talking about. the project was good. You know, obviously had potential. There was an originality there. You know, other than that, it was just based on your academic record. And also, I did, because I didn't know you, I took up the references as well. And the references were very convincing too. So yeah. It was a risk, but
it paid off.
Yeah, absolutely.
So references. Yeah, we've talked about those before on the show and how important they are, especially if you're applying for something and people don't know you yet. So you need to make sure you pick the right ones.
I mean, normally if somebody's coming through from one of the MAs, we know them already, and we wouldn't even bother with references anyway, because we know what
that makes
like.
Sense.
But yeah, definitely for somebody coming from outside. I would always want references. Yeah, I think I did for Sarah as well, even though I had actually met her. I didn't, you know, obviously really know her.
And really work together. Makes sense. And in your opinion, what are some of the things to watch out for when you pick your supervisor? So you said already it should be a fairly close match between your project and the research field of the supervisor. Is there anything else that you think is important?
I think it's difficult for me, because I'm looking at it kind of from the other direction, from my direction. But yeah, I mean that match is quite important, and certainly, you know, I talked earlier about having too many PhD supervisees. I basically accepted projects that my expertise was much more kind of tangential to what the person actually wanted to do. Whereas nowadays I would be wanting to take on supervisees whose research is really quite close to mine, I think. Because, I mean, apart from anything else, I can offer much better feedback on drafts and much better recommendations for reading, and have much better kind of give and take conversations, I think, with somebody where the research interests match up fairly closely. Sorry, what was the question?
Some of the things to watch out for when you pick a supervisor.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, that match is important. I think I suppose you might want to check out their record in terms of successfully transitioning people through that PhD. Are they experienced in PhD supervision? Have they got a track record of successfully, you know, guiding people through that process, and you know, getting people to completion? And also, you know, look at their publication record. Are they research active? I suppose seniority comes into it as well. I'm just thinking about my own experience. Like, I did my BA and MA at Bristol, and it was my MA dissertation supervisor who suggested that I should look elsewhere. You know, even though they would have happily kept me there, he said it'd be good for your academic career to move somewhere else. So it was him who recommended my, both the institution in Nottingham and the supervisor that I had at Nottingham. So it's him that put me in touch with her. Now, her research interests were reasonably close. Like, she had a certain expertise in Jewish American literature, and she at least knew who Henry Roth was, which, you know, a lot of academics wouldn't. But there was also her seniority, the fact that she, you know, she guided a lot of people through PhD successfully. She was a professor. She got, you know, a really good reputation. So, you know, there's that kind of thing as well. And she's a fantastic supervisor. Like, really, really erudite, and just would recommend stuff from kind of theoretical stuff from kind of left field, or you know, theorists who've been kind of forgotten.
Yeah.
She would know this kind of stuff. So I think, you know, somebody with a really good, like, academic track record.
Yeah.
Is what you're looking for.
Because it's interesting. I've spoken to someone who did a PhD in England recently, and she dropped out after 2 years, and only realized after that the PhD supervisor she had picked had about a 70-75% track record of PhD students dropping out.
Yeah.
She took a lot on, but there was always issues when it came to completion, but she only realized that after. So that's kind of how I modeled this question, because I was like, oh, okay, so I didn't even think about looking that kind of stuff up.
It's definitely worth finding that out if you can. Now, I can't imagine that it would be the easiest thing to find out.
Yeah. Where would you look for something like that? Unless people don't put that on their research profile.
Well, exactly. No, you wouldn't. If there was some kind of informal means of making a few tentative inquiries, that's probably a good idea.
Yeah. Maybe like reaching out to a PhD students that they have.
Yeah.
Would have been my best guess. And
if you can.
Yeah. If that's somewhere on the website, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways it sounds a little bit underhand doing that, but at the same time, you know, you're investing 3 or 4 years of your life in this process, and an awful lot of money as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's important that you do get that good relationship, a satisfactory match-up with your supervisor.
Yeah, and based on what you said, and again, I'm comparing that to a conversation that I had with a friend of mine who also dropped out, and they were kind of more looking at the reputation of the university over the research field and the research interests of their supervisors necessarily.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be a bit of a pitfall as well, to go for the name of the university instead of focusing more on the individual that would be supervising you.
Yeah, I think that's true. I can go on personal experience a little bit there as well, because when I applied to Nottingham to do the PhD, I also applied to Cambridge, and I was offered a place at Cambridge and Nottingham. But the Cambridge one was, they asked if I would defer for a year because the potential supervisor was going on a sabbatical.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, well, yeah, I suppose I could do that. And everyone was saying to me at that point, I'll do a year at Nottingham and then transfer over to Cambridge. I thought, yeah, really? And then when I got to Nottingham, it just had such a kind of vibrant PhD culture, really good department, really good kind of coterie of PhD students that work well together, really good kind of structures in place. There was no way I was going to then leave to Cambridge and just be, you know, a kind of isolated individual in no kind of American studies department.
Yeah.
Just there on the reputation of the supervisor. I mean, it's pretty, you know, it's a fairly prestigious supervisor who I'm sure would have been very good. But then actually, I think he left Cambridge. He didn't come back after his sabbatical, so the whole thing would have fallen apart anyway.
Oh, Jesus.
So yeah, I would say, yeah, the reputation, I think the academic standing of the supervisor and the supervisor's experience of PhD supervision, I would say is more important than the reputation of the university that you go into.
It's really interesting. There's a lot of stuff that I didn't know. It was really cool to learn all that stuff about your PhD experience as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff I'm kind of remembering now because it's quite a while ago now.
There's a lot of overlaps as well because I think you were on sabbatical when I reached out first about my project.
I think that's right. Yeah. It's either that or I was doing the associate dean role.
Mm-hmm.
So there were various things going on that kind of got in the way a little bit. But
yeah.
But again, you know, I mean, your tenaciousness was good.
I was like a pit bull.
No, it's good. It gave me a bit of a kick up the ass and made me think, well, this person really is keen and the project is good. They seem good. They seem really keen, you know.
I think I'm blushing a bit in embarrassment. It's like, yep, super keen, great.
Well, I mean, look how quickly you finished. So, you know,
I suppose. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I knew that you took a leap of faith, so I wanted to be the least hassle experience for you as possible.
Oh, yeah, you repaid that, certainly.
And I suppose if we flip the coin a small bit, right? So we talked about kind of the watch outs for when you pick a supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
But what are some of the things that you look for in a good supervisee? So are there any like even red flags where you got applications and you were like, I don't think that's a good match?
There's a couple of red flags in written applications, I'd say, especially if somebody is approaching me on spec or somebody who I know a little bit, perhaps. Firstly, if they're writing a proposal or an email that's just poorly written in terms of the standard of English, that would be an immediate red flag because I'd be thinking, you know, is part of the supervision process with this person going to be teaching them how to write, to write good English, and I don't want to be doing that at PhD level.
Mm.
So there's that. Secondly, if somebody is approaching me with a project but they're not really sure what they're doing and it's a very kind of vague thing and I'd like to do a bit of research about maybe this, maybe that, you know, again, we've talked about this investment of time that you're doing when you're doing a PhD project. If you're going to be doing that, you want to be sure that this is a project that is going to maintain your interest for 3 or 4 years. And so you're going to have a fairly decent idea what it is you're going to be doing from the start. So those would be the two things that would be kind of slight red flags. Three things, actually, I suppose. Poor standard of English, poorly oriented project. And the third thing, which I didn't mention, which is maybe kind of obvious, which is a poor matchup with my own research interests.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, really, these days, I'd be looking at something that would focus on preferably contemporary American literature and culture and or representations of trauma and or naturalism. It'd have to be one of those three, I think.
And out of, you know, all the people that reach out to you about a potential supervision or PhD supervision, like, how many would you say are of interest and how many you get back to and are like, great, thanks, but I don't think this is a good match necessarily.
Yeah, it depends what you count, because if you're counting very tentative inquiries from somebody from overseas who just you know, is putting a toe in the water and maybe sending the same thing to 20 or 30 people, then most of those probably aren't of that much interest.
Yeah.
It's difficult to put a figure on it, really, because you're talking about quite different things. You know, you're talking about those on the one hand, or on one end of the spectrum, and on the other end of the spectrum, somebody that I know very well from doing one of the MA courses here, who probably has got a much better chance of me entertaining their proposal simply because we've got a better chance of kind of discussing it and thrashing it through and maybe reorientating it if need be.
Bit of proximity bias, but also you know their writing style, you know, you've probably read some of their work already.
Yeah, and also they know my work better. So you know, they're probably approaching me more with, you know, being somewhat informed, I suppose, as to, you know, that they're approaching me because they know I'm the trauma guy. <if you like. laughs> It does happen.
And now that we talked about kind of this reaching out process and trying to find someone who could supervise you, and let's say that all goes great, and 'cause when I started, it was people were telling me, oh, you know, there's not really a formal process of going through a university and saying, I would like to be supervised by Dr. A, B, and C. The way it was explained to me was you need to come up with a project, you need to pre-research it, you need to come up with a couple of people who could be good supervisors because they're experts in the field. And it's quite funny because I, like, when I started researching, I found your work and I was like, that's him. what you were saying there, again, super keen, right?
Yeah.
I'm blushing again in embarrassment. but it was like, this process was explained to me of, okay, so you need to build this relationship first of like, this is my project. Is there, you know, is there any input that you can give me, any help? And like building a bit of rapport and like back and forth. And then the way it was explained to me at the time was, it's not like you ask, but it's like they offer. Like, is it was like almost like they then say, oh, if you're interested in doing this project with me, I have availabilities, kind of.
Yeah.
So...
It's a difficult one again to quantify because I think that initial approach is always somewhat informal, and that's fine. That's as it should be because, yeah, I mean, you want to make that initial approach to a potential supervisor and see, well, A, if they have an interest in the project, if it's a close enough match, and B, do they have the capacity? Because you know, we do have people. Who approach the department, and they often come through me because I'm the chair of the Graduate Studies Committee. So they often come through me and I will pass them on to the most relevant member of staff. But you know, if that member of staff already has a full, you know, is already full to capacity with PhD students, there's not really much we can do, unfortunately. Yeah. There's only so many that we can take on at one time. So we have had to, unfortunately, you know, turn one or two people down in the last few years just because, you know, certain member of staff or certain members of staff are full, you know, full to capacity.
Yeah.
And that does happen. You know, in that case, we'll just, you know, wish somebody the best of luck finding a place for the projects elsewhere. And sometimes we might be able to suggest another supervisor or another institution to approach. But yeah, that can happen. But yeah, certainly that initial approach is necessarily informal, I think, and it's just really you are kind of fishing in a way to see if the supervisor is interested, has capacity, and in principle will take you on. And then the more formal process kicks in of you know, writing a proper proposal and detailing your methodology and so on and so forth.
Great lead in into the next question, which is, in your opinion, what makes a good PhD application? So this proposal piece, the methodology piece, and in my mind, I'm having a very hard time distinguishing my application to when I first started and doing my first funding application.
Right. Yeah.
But I must have written a PhD application, a formal one, at some stage. Maybe it's traumatic memory and I can't access it anymore.
No, you did, definitely, because I mean that would have been one of the things I most certainly like based the decision on. But yeah, I mean, after that informal approach, the next thing really is to work on a kind of more formal PhD proposal, which would be usually about 1,500 words, I'd say, and should include key things such as, you know, the whichever authors or genres or what texts, the corpus of texts that you're intending to study, why they should be studied. Because, you know, obviously part of the way in which a PhD is judged a success or failure, the thesis is judged a success or failure, is whether it constitutes a contribution to knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So there should be a certain element of originality there.
Yeah.
There should be a contribution to scholarship on a particular author. So there should be some kind of new approach to an author's works or a body of texts that you're bringing together. So that needs to be there. It needs to be explained why this project needs to be done, why it needs to be done now, why it's kind of timely now.
Mm-hmm.
At the heart of a good proposal as well is the kind of research methodology. So what theoretical approaches you're using, is it archive-based? Are you intending to go to visit certain archives during the course of this? Are there people that need to be interviewed, so on and so forth? But the real, like, absolute core of any PhD proposal, I think, is the research question. The thesis question, and there's got to be a question or maybe two questions that the PhD research is seeking to answer. This is one of the kind of differences, I think, between academic work that students might have done before PhD compared to what they do after. I suppose the MA dissertation would be the first time where you're really kind of setting a question for yourself to answer.
Yeah.
If you don't have a if you don't have a thesis question, which is at the centre of everything you do for your PhD thesis, then it's going to remain kind of unfocused.
Yeah, still vague, kind of.
Yeah. So, like with mine, for example, I suppose my PhD thesis question boiled down to, why did Henry Roth return to writing and publishing 60 years after publishing his first novel?
Very compelling.
Well, yeah, it is. And like, but basically everything I wrote in that thesis, okay, it approached it from many different directions answering that question, but everything could be traced back to that question.
Yeah.
And I think probably the same with yours. There's probably a central question.
I'm wrecking my brain. I'm not entirely sure what mine was. Generally, it must have had something to do with why has nobody looked at trauma representations in high school shooting literature before.
Yeah.
Like, it must have been something like that, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean that points to a strength of your research, excuse me, which was the originality angle. Because, you know, that was a really compelling part of your proposal, the fact that you'd identify that there was this dearth of critical writing on quite a significant body of literature.
Yeah.
So that was the immediate kind of whatever the opposite of a red flag is. That was like, oh, this is, you know, she's obviously really thought about this. This is a good, solid core of that proposal.
And it's one of those things, because when I started, I had this, during the master's, I had this hankering to do a PhD. It was always kind of in the back of my mind, but I wouldn't call myself the most creative person. And I always struggled to come up with essay topics with my MA topic, and like that was very much out there, and people in my department at Bristol would tell me, this is too much out there, like you cannot work on this, it's not going to work, it's going to fall through. And there was only one person who then took me on as a supervisee for my MA thesis. So I always struggled to come up with good essay topics, my MA topic, and it took me a solid 2 years to come up with the PhD topic. And then at the time when things fell into place and I actually realized, yes, trauma is the lens that I need to look through, but then how has nobody else done this yet? And it was like this massive light bulb moment, and everything just fell into place. And it was weird. It's like one of these days that you like just remember. You know, you remember where you were and you remember what happened, and I don't even know where I'm getting at with this, but I always struggle to come up with my own topic. And maybe that's why I can't remember my research question off the top of my head now. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that if you struggle with this, there's always ways to find these areas that haven't been explored yet. It might just take a while to find them, I suppose.
And it's worth taking your time, because I think I mentioned this earlier, you do want something that is going to absorb your interest for 3 or 4 years. Yours is quite interesting and unusual in that yours is not really that connected with your MA project. Whereas I'd say almost eight or nine times out of ten, people's PhD project is more or less directly related to the MA dissertation. It's quite often just an expanded version of the MA dissertation. Certainly mine was.
Something I struggled with a lot, because I've talked about this before in former episodes, I come from a 19th century background. Mm. I have a master's in Victorian literature, and the only connection between my MA thesis and my PhD was that I compared Frankenstein's creature and the way the creature is rejected and the way he reacts and the mental state that he's in terms of he's just been revived and he's going through the developmental stages and reaches almost like teenager age in terms of brain development, and then experiences this rejection and then lashes out in a lethal way. Yeah. And that in my brain, I don't know, I connected that to, okay, so what if that happened nowadays and yeah, I ended up with school shooters?
Yeah.
And I think that is the only bit that carried through into the PhD thesis then, because I thought, okay, I'm going to work more on like Gothic and Frankenstein and all of that. That was one avenue that I was going to go down. But again, we all know that 19th century literature is so crowded. A crowded space in terms of academia and academic writing. So I went down this other way, but then obviously I had to find a different theory to work with, right? Yeah. Or a different lens to look through. And that's why it took so long, kind of. So I never came from like, I never took one module in American literature.
Yeah.
Or trauma. It was all self-taught. Right. Wow. So it was this kind of idea of I struggled with my identity as a researcher as I went through as well, because obviously for my thesis and for my project, I had to attend a lot of Americanist conferences, and I always thought that I was kind of like the outlier and I didn't know enough and my imposter syndrome was just through the roof, because it wasn't part of what I had studied the entire time from my undergrad to my postgrad.
Yeah.
Well, I knew my stuff, kind of.
I mean, that thing about imposter syndrome is you must have talked about this quite a lot, I would imagine, on the podcast before anyway, because it's just an inevitable massive part of being a PhD student. Mm-hmm. You feel like a lot of the time you're faking it. So yeah, I suppose it would be doubly so in your case, having switched kind of subjects and theoretical approaches quite significantly. I mean, you brought in the Gothic stuff with your reading of We Need to Talk About Kevin.
I managed to squeeze it in.
Yeah. And I mean, that was good. That was good. I mean, that's another important part, I think, of PhD research, though, that flexibility to bring in theoretical approaches from seemingly quite diverse areas. I think that can lead to really, really interesting research.
Mm. So maybe it helped in the end to like have a more diverse background.
Well, it's I mean, it's led to you having a really kind of rich academic mix now, surely, because you've got all the kind of 19th century Gothic stuff that you did previously, and you know, you've also absorbed all the trauma stuff and you know, you're clawing your way into being an Americanist as well. So like, you know, it's quite a lot to draw on now.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, that must be quite rewarding, I suppose, at the end of it.
Nice.
To have all that stuff that you've done.
It's nice at the end. It's sometimes I regret not doing 4 years, not giving myself that extra year.
Yeah.
Because I think it was really in the last year. And again, it's a shame because my experience also got cut short because of COVID, obviously. Our supervisor meetings moved online we were off campus. There was no conferences anymore, really, especially at the start. So just before COVID hit, I feel like I really came into my own in terms of embracing this. Yes, I'm a 19th century Gothic scholar, but I'm working on a contemporary trauma PhD. Mm. I can take all of this and it doesn't have to be one or the other. It can be both, and I can, you know, find synergies between the two and kind of combine them. And I think I only came into my own in the last couple of months before March 2020. Right. So there was kind of like and it was cut short that. Yeah. So I wish sometimes I would have had that one more year where I could develop that a bit more in terms of like my own research identity.
Sure.
If that makes sense. But I mean, yeah.
I don't think that's a particularly unusual feeling to feel like you only needed a few more months and you could have got this damn thing perfect. It leads me to something I think you wanted to ask me about, the sort of golden bit of advice that, that I was given at one point. And it was something I was advised, I think, during the induction at Nottingham, one of the events there. Just one of the professors, I think he's a professor of history, but he was in the American department, said that, and I've used this so many times with other PhDs, so people are probably tired of hearing it, but just regard the PhD thesis not as an end in itself, but as a means to an end. That the PhD thesis is a means to getting through the Viva exam. Get it good enough to do that. If you're going to work on it to perfect it, then you're going to take like 12, 15 years to do your PhD. So, you know, you want to stand over it. You want to have something that you're proud of. But if you're going to take forever to perfect it, then you will indeed take forever. So
you told me that in our very first meeting.
I probably told you that several times.
Yeah. You did, but you also did it in our very first meeting. And I was like, oh, what?
No, it was a real, like, the scales dropped for me when I heard that. But it always struck me as, like, astoundingly good advice.
It is very good because that is essentially what it is.
When
it boils down, it's more like the script for the Viva at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And it's more particular to here because if you do a PhD in Germany, your script for your Viva, which is your PhD thesis essentially, needs to get published for you to pass.
Right.
So I think the stakes there are different.
Yeah.
In terms of, but it's so right because once you get stuck in this perfectionism aspect and you want to get it just right, but you never get there. You know, it's never going to be like perfect.
Yeah.
You can be happy with it, but then obviously academia moves on as well. So it's thing of, you know, it can never be like fully done.
Yeah.
Is what I'm trying to say, I suppose.
It goes on even now, you know. I mean, everything, or, you know, most things I've published, I've always thought that was better in my head before I actually put it down on paper. I had a piece published in the Journal of American Studies about a year or so ago, and it's literally like the first time in my academic career that I've thought that was actually really good. I'm really, really proud of that. That's probably the best thing I've written.
Yeah.
But it's rare to feel that way, I think. Yeah.
That's why I haven't really gone over my old writing yet, because I feel like...
Oh, I never do that.
The level of cringe would just be too bad.
Yeah, never look back.
Well, it's interesting, because what you touch on reminds me of a concept that I learned in linguistics classes when I did my undergrad in British Studies, which is, in linguistics, this concept of competence versus performance in terms of language. So in your head, you have the perfect grammar, you can, you know, spell out the perfect sentence, but what comes out in terms of performance then never matches up what you could potentially reach in terms of competence.
Yeah.
So I think we all have it. It's a universal thing.
I think it's Thurston Moore, the guy from Sonic Youth. I remember some interview with him where he said some quotation that he came out with, something like, music is compromised as soon as it comes out of your head. So as soon as you try and, you know, turn this thing in your head into a song that you're playing with a band, it's already gone. It's already not as good as it was when it was in your head. And it's true. Yeah.
Yeah. That's exactly what it is, right? Yeah. It's never. Yeah. It's, but it's also hard to then say goodbye to the project and kind of let it go.
Yeah. You have to be kind of, it is your child that you have to, you know, you have to let it go, send it out into the world and,
similar enough.
Yeah,
but that's all really good advice.
So this is it for the first part of our supervisor special and our season 7 finale. We'll see you again in 2 weeks' time with part 2. This episode of PhD Pending was written and produced by me, Anna Mahler. Artwork by Jerome Kelleher. Support the show and rate us 5 stars in your favorite podcast app. You can also subscribe to our Patreon for exclusive bonus content, or if you prefer a once-off donation, head to our Buy Me a Coffee page. The links to both are in the show notes. You can find the show on Instagram and Twitter at phdpenningpod, or send an email to phdpenningpod@gmail.com.